This is Art/Geek with Russ Olson
and Chris Bailey.
I read recently, you might have seen it, there was an article, I think it was in Wired, about the guy who wants to put a, is it a UPC symbol on every...
Species.
Yes. Yeah, and that there are a lot of people resistant to that, that feel that it either it's not going to give the same results as old school recording.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as he's concerned, and obviously the people who are working with him, they feel like it's a worthwhile endeavor,
right?
Because right. You can at least capture that data and have it located rather than some obscure museum that happens to have 500 birds,
right?
Sitting in some drawer and you don't know anything about them. At least they have
some identifying thing on them. It's an interesting idea. I think people are sort of frightened of numbering things or lettering them or whatever when they're sort of attached to them.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly we're all sort of attached to living things, but I don't know that I have an opinion on that, except that if it helps keep a few more of those things around, surely. Mm-hmm.
I was also thinking about, if you can't even do that with one species and feel confident that you've, nailed down every detail.
Right.
And there are all these species that, we don't even know
right. What
is alive in this planet.
Right. There's actually an interesting, there was this character, this guy who died a few years ago, maybe more than a few years ago, a guy named Thomas Gold, who was a physicist, and his ideas came to one of two fates. They were either spectacularly successful or spectacularly not successful, but he tended not to have ideas in the middle.
All right.
And
a big thinker.
Yeah. But his ideas were right often enough that people would listen to him. And one of his ideas that I think most geologists would say are nonsense, but what do I know? I'm certainly not. But one of his ideas is that there's basically living things all the way down miles below the surface. That, as you go deeper and deeper into the Earth's crust or whatever, it gets hotter and hotter. Mm-hmm. And the conventional wisdom is that while there might be some living things under the ground but close to the surface, as you go any distance down, they're going to thin out to zero.
Mm-hmm.
And Thomas Gold was of the opinion that no, there was this, he called it the deep hot biosphere, that there were significant numbers of bacteria and things alive, very, very deep, mm-hmm. like oil well, miles deep. And that had implications for like the oil supply and things like that. But if anything like that is true, then then there's more things alive under the ground than there are on the surface.
And how many things might be down there that we're not even aware of?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. I know that's where the monsters live.
Yeah, okay.
And I imagine that if oil was once living matter, that maybe something would be alive in it. It's not impossible.
Well, Thomas Gold's view, and again, I emphasize that this is a fairly fringe view, and I think mm-hmm. people would, anybody with a geology degree would most likely say it's nonsense, mm-hmm. but it's an interesting idea. His view was that if you go sort of to the outer solar system, like out by Jupiter and Saturn, there are whole moons where significant portions of the moon are made up of organic compounds, just naturally not alive, but things like natural gas and mm-hmm. Other things like that, and that if the Earth had some significant amount of that when it formed that's somehow underground, that in fact the oil is not sort of the trees that the dinosaurs were stomping mm-hmm. on, but that the oil actually is sort of a naturally occurring part of the Earth that's been processed by this deep life, and that's what the deep life is actually living on for the most part. So when they find like clear signs that there were that the oil was sort of a product of living things, Thomas Gold would tell you that, yeah, it's a product of the bacteria that's living down there, that's living off of this primordial stuff. Oh. Okay. And so his view was that we're nowhere near running out of oil because it's a naturally occurring substance. And
so if you leave soda in a can long enough, you might be able to use it in an engine. I'll try that at home today.
Yeah. Probably your daughter's running that experiment in the bedroom right now, and you don't know it.
I also heard recently, yesterday, I read that there was some study about how by connecting the Mississippi River to the Great Lakes, there have been species moving into the Great Lakes that
shouldn't ought to be there.
That could be devastating to some of the natural population.
Yeah,
in the water.
I think there's a fair amount of that going on.
To even think about those things, I mean, that is so alien. It's our planet, but you know, it's not something that most of us know anything about.
Yeah, well, part of it is that these kinds of things happen all the time. I mean, creatures migrate and all that kind of stuff. So on the one hand, you don't want to be panicky about it. But on the other hand, we don't really want to screw things up either.
Yeah. Well, and historically, there would probably be change in wind patterns or something that would move a tree seed or a bug or something.
Right. Distance. You could think of it from the reptiles' point of view. There was a time hundreds of millions of years ago where the reptiles were everywhere, and then there was this invasive group of animals called mammals that came along and got lucky. But the problem is, I mean, in all seriousness, the problem is that if we change things, we change things on a very rapid scale. Mm-hmm. You know, the dinosaurs died out over, you know, what would seem to us to be a fairly lengthy period of time. They're already, I think, sort of in decline when the asteroid did them in and things. But we tend to go in and do things in the space of a year or 10 years or 100 years, and that really has a danger of seriously screwing things up, if for no one else, for us. Mm-hmm. I mean, the heck with the moral implications of all this. We're going to, screw up our own spot here.
Particularly since we don't know, although many of us expect that, or are pretty sure that there will be long-lasting implications, that when you pull something out of an ecosystem, there could be problems associated with it. You can't even begin to predict.
Right. Well, the thing is that people, I think, in general, quite like complexity. We like a nice ecosystem with lots of different, the rainforest, right? Mm-hmm. There's a bazillion different species of insects. And I think what tends to happen when you introduce like rabbits into Australia where they have no natural enemies, you get a lot of the same. You get a lot of rabbits. Mm-hmm. And going back to the theme of the show, that's not very artsy. It's not very pretty to just have rabbits everywhere.
Yeah. You make a sweater and a stew, you're stuck with rabbits.
Yeah, good gloves.
Yeah. Wow.
And be very lucky you could have rabbit's foot, you know?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So. Well, I know in England, I was amazed. They tend to, I don't know if they keep more sheep. I'm not sure how it came about, but you go into the countryside, and where sheep are, there are no trees.
Oh, right.
Because
right.
They'll eat anything.
Oh, right.
And they'll eat the saplings. They'll eat the small trees, and they never
grow
catch
back.
On.
Yeah.
And so it'll be these, it's grass all the way up to these stone fences and almost nothing else.
Right, right.
And it's so manicured looking, and it's kind of interesting.
Uh-huh.
But when you have to look a long distance to even see a cluster of trees, there's something very odd about it.
Mm.
And perhaps it's just something that, here in the United States, you never see that.
Well, having been to England a couple of times myself, when I look at the English countryside, I like the fact that they keep their towns where their towns are and everything else other places. You really feel the sprawl of cities in the United States or towns or whatever, where we're very spread out, and you drive out of, say, Washington, D.C., And first it's very dense, then it's kind of medium dense, then it's less dense, then it's still less dense, and then you're sort of out in the country. Mm-hmm. Where in England, it's more like you're in the city, you're in the town, you're out.
Yeah.
And that I sort of like. I like the fact, but that's probably because I'm a city boy and I like to get out of the city and just plain be out of it.
Yeah, I think they make good use of it that way. It's difficult. I've tried this before to, like, how far would I have to go to get out of town here?
Yeah.
And you really do have to go quite a way.
Yes.
Just even to get out of the light in the night sky.
Right.
And part of that, you know, on the East Coast, it's not like that all over the country. And we certainly have a lot more people to deal with.
Right. But you could say, I mean, look at it this way. That's where most of the people live. Mm-hmm. So most people are in the United States anyway are experiencing exactly what you're experiencing because they're experiencing it because that's where they are.
Yeah. So they all decide the same weekend to go to the Outer Banks.
Yeah,
right.
That would be Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think that proves that the French are smarter than us because they do it for a whole month, so they only have to suffer, one coming and going.
Yeah, but you think you could stagger it a month, go when everyone else is here, you know.
Well, I think we've probably run out of time. So this has been Art/Geek with Russ Olson
and Chris Bailey.